You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
War, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast, where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is Skin of Evil. I'm Ben from Arizona.
And I'm James from London.
And I'm Blue. Why have you come?
I'm sorry. I'm Lou from Nebraska.
Hi, Lou. How are you?
I'm doing fine. And tonight we do have that special guest on who sounds like he's done this before. Is that true?
Once or twice. And I even sometimes mimic it while you read it.
Yeah?
On the podcast. Yeah, why not?
Okay. So why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are, your introduction to Star Trek, and what do you do?
Man, I haven't been asked to tell my origins of Star Trek in quite a long time. I feel it's real special. But I'll just go with it then, because it's appropriate for this podcast. But as a kid, my dad would watch this show, The Next Generation, and I was far too young to stay up when it first started. I believe it aired at like 8 or 9 o'clock, and my bedtime was before that. And so I do remember like memories of a bald man in a red shirt on television, and that this was Star Trek. Well, one day, it was a summertime, and I was off school, and I just got a television for that summer, an old dial television, a UHF knob television. And while I was on the background, a show called Star Trek came up, and it happened to be Arena, the one with Captain Kirk and the Gorn. And I started watching my dad stop by. He must have heard the music, as distinct as it is. He must have wondered what I was doing. And he came by, and we sat down and watched that episode, and I loved it, of course. But when I asked, like, he said, this is Star Trek. I said, that's not possible. You know, the captain's bald. He's like, no, this is the original captain, Captain Kirk. Which, of course, the original, you know, I mean, that is, that's got some weight. But anyhow, it got me interested in watching the movies and whatnot. And then the next year, or after the summer was over, when school started back up and the TV schedule resumed, he was watching The Next Generation. And I wanted to watch it. And I asked if I could. So that meant an hour later bedtime, but he agrees. So that's how I started watching it, and I've been watching it since. And so it kind of goes to show though why I think this season and this show so much, especially, is because I grew up with it.
Okay. All right, and you host a podcast yourself?
Yeah, we do that too.
You do that too.
But that's the Voyager. That's the Voyager podcast, and honestly, you don't need to watch Voyager.
You don't need to watch Voyager?
Well, not if you haven't watched Next Generation. You have to watch Next Generation first.
Yeah, and then you got to go to TNG, and then you got to go to DS9, and then you go to Voyager, and then you go to Enterprise. I don't see that you can start with Enterprise ever.
Well, I would go personally. I would go, since we're on this topic, I would go TNG, Voyager, depending on your age. If you're a little kid, I'd go Voyager, TNG. But as an adult, I go TNG, Voyager, TOS, Deep Space Nine, and then you can finish with Enterprise.
Okay.
That does not reflect their quality. Their order does not reflect their quality, of course.
But I guess that makes sense, because if you know, some people might stop at the space hippies and go, nope, can't do this.
Yeah, that is right.
I mean, just a question out there. If you're kind of pushing someone towards TNG, do you tell them to start from the beginning or to start from season 3?
Always the same episode, The Defector. That's the first episode I show anybody they want to watch.
Oh.
Defector's very, 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 very good.
Yep.
It's good for everybody as well. Hmm. I might even show this episode, maybe, sometimes.
Yeah, it's not as good as The Defector.
No,
that's a top 5.
Mm. Yeah, but you said they're all 5 out of 5.
Well, yeah, everything's 5 stars.
I read that, and I don't know if you heard my response, but I go, wait a minute, is this the same Ben that does the Delta Quadrant? Because there's no way he's given 5 out of 5s. But TNG is sometimes the best.
That's true. But in true TDQ fashion, we'll get there when we get there, Lou. But we're not there yet.
All right. Okay. Whereas I still say, you know, when it comes to Star Trek and the true meaning of Star Trek, what Gene Roddenberry sat down on his typewriter in 1964, I think Voyager comes close to all the others because he had no choice but to explore. So.
Oh, no. Voyager is as close to the original series as you get.
Yeah.
It's just a different time frame, time period.
Absolutely. You know. It's a way of shoving it to the censors who said, no, you can't have a woman on the bridge. Not going to work. So, all right, then. And where can it be found?
Just like this podcast, you can find it on the TrekMate Family Network or TrekMate Network. Or you can see us on the forums and all that stuff. But we review episodes of Voyager. We're in Season 6, late in Season 6 now, or midway through Season 6, or third of the way through Season 6. It feels like a long time, though. But we're right in the middle of all that those good episodes, and yeah, so join us if you want.
Exactly, just like us, that's where we get our idea of having guests on was from the Delta Quadrant. Now, have you at all given my suggestion any consideration?
You're talking about our Season 8
yeah.
suggestion? Yeah. You've had a lot of Season 8 suggestions, it's looking like here. I think they're all good suggestions. I don't see a single one that I would balk too heavily at, except for maybe somebody said we should do a Sequest DSV review. That is not happening.
A what? But I'm sorry, a what?
A Sequest DSV episode review. And I can promise you that's not happening.
Oh, okay. No, I was thinking, the person who wants to come on and guest for Season 8 actually has to come up with the script.
Yeah, I agree. Yep. As a matter of fact, I haven't seen any script submissions yet. I am waiting. Patiently.
Well, I think unless you guys are really going to, do that, no one's going to wait. No one's going to take the time.
Yeah, but we can't put the cart before the horse. We need the material to do the shows, so the material has to come in before the show can begin.
Definitely. Okay, well then, say hi to Melissa.
I will. I won't see her for the Trek convention, though. She's not going to be able to make it this year, unfortunately, which is very sad.
Tell her we're waiting for her to come on the show and talk about some TNG. Okay. Right. Well then, nice to have you on. Why don't you continue on?
The synopsis for tonight's show is, a rescue operation to save the lives of the shuttle crew cost the Enterprise one of its own. This is the 23rd episode of Season 1 of Star Trek The Next Generation. Original release date, April 25th, 1988. The episode was written by Joseph Stefano and Hannah Louise Scheer and directed by Joseph Scanlan. The guest stars include Mark McKenzie as Armus, Ron Gans as the voice of Armus, Walker Boone as Leland T. Lynch, Brad Zerps as Nurse, Raymond Fortune as Ben Prieto. So what do we think about this episode? I think that this episode is awesome. What do you think, James?
So, really? Wow, you've stumped me. why did it come to me first? I think this episode's not particularly awesome. Over to you, Lou.
I think this episode is not particularly awesome, but really becomes awesome, daring, and bold, and then very sad.
Oh, we need to do some forum feedback.
Oh, yes.
Do we not?
Yes, we do. Ben, would you mind if we read a little bit of forum? And you can comment on it if you wish.
I would love to do so.
Okay, and we left off on coming of age, the Wesley exam, the entrance exam. You know, the exam to see if you could take an exam to see if you can go on to. Kieran McDuff starts this one out that says, I completely agree with James on this episode. the portrayal of Starfleet is ridiculously hard to get into, flies in the face of every other time the Academy is ever referenced in Star Trek. Yes, there would be entry requirements, but I cannot see how it would possibly be the case that these requirements would be to win the right to represent a starship in a contest against another handful of cadets who we assume also had to fight to get there. Only one of those will get through. I don't see Starfleet as being the best of the best. I'm sure Starfleet encourages that, but they'll promote the best through their own ranks, given them positions on the best starship, or even special ops, which I'm sure happen. I don't mean Section 31. Regardless, they still need to fill the other roles. There's no reason that this testing couldn't be used to screen Academy cadets to see if they're ready. If that's what it was doing, then it makes perfect sense. But that's not what they're doing. Otherwise, Wesley would have gotten into the Academy as well. That just makes me think the writers made this unnecessarily restrictive so that we wouldn't lose Wesley from the Enterprise too soon. Understandable, but if you're bending a plot point that much to ensure you keep things the way you want them, then maybe you need to rethink your plot point. Or I guess I would say just leave the whole thing out altogether.
You can't leave the whole thing out together.
Yeah, we could talk about it. But I would also agree that this is quite a good episode. As I say, I like the testing in general, but also the setup for conspiracy doesn't seem to make much sense at the time, but we get the payoff in the later episode. In this one, it's just a good way to question what we've seen so far. I actually like that there may be repercussions for the decisions they've taken in previous episodes. Quinn seems reasonable enough, but they never clear up if he's already in the conspiracy or if that just happens later. Nor do they mention how far along Remick might be. Is he a good guy or a bad guy at this point in time? Does he host the alien? They might come back to it later, but they do leave out a few unanswered questions. You know, before I go on to the bad part here, that's a very good point, Doc. Did we ever come up with the idea that Quinn or Remick may have already been infected and they were just trying to maybe put Picard in the key role for the Academy and get to him later?
By the way, I actually listened to the episode because I am a loyal listener as well as actually being on the show. And I heard us discuss this, and it did make me think about where I stood on where we currently stand from the perspective of the invasion. And in my mind, I think it works better to believe that at this stage, they don't know anything and they're just reacting to either rumors or to other things going on. I don't think they've been infected yet. Okay. And I don't think the Admiral gets... there's the bit in Conspiracy where there's a shift between when people meet him at the beginning of the episode and when they meet him again, you know, a little bit later down the line. So when they meet up on, I think it's Pacifica, right? And he's very much warning of things. I think he's still very clearly not part of the group. And then he becomes part of the group later on in that episode. So I think at this point, we're just in the paranoia phase.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Remick is a mean guy, though. See how I did that? Maybe he was meant to be that way to interrogate everyone, but he milks it dry. After all that, he then has the cheek of saying he'd like to serve on the Enterprise. What does he mean by the cheek of saying? James?
The goal.
Okay. I didn't know if that was something from the UK or something. Well, he might be a mean guy, but he's a mean guy with massive I don't know, cojones. Now, I do want to mention one thing. I'm sorry, before you do, but I do want to mention one thing, guys. I know Trekmate Family has its own rules, its own philosophy, and some of our podcasts really do get, I want to say, sometimes unfamily friendly, but this show is also a member of Tech Podcast, and one of the number one requirements is that our show does remain family friendly, which is why we can't read what he wrote there. And I had to change some of the words. Now, when it comes to the dams and the hells and the crabs or whatever, we could do that. But some of the stuff he wrote, we just can't put down. Or we just can't say. So, James, go ahead.
Sorry, I was actually following the script as you were reading this, and I thought you were going to refer to it as, he might be a mean guy, but he's a mean guy with a big mean guy.
Yes! No, he's a mean guy with a pretty big mean guy. I mean, he must have some big mean guys. But anyway. Okay, so let me go on. And that's just a little. I know you could do it on TrekMate. Go for it. It doesn't matter. We'll alter, or when we do say something, I can enter the... So, no problem. Now, the Jake...
That was, by the way, listeners, that was not a computerized version of the blue. That was Lou. That was pretty good, man.
Really? The Jake Curlin bit just seemed like filler. If that wasn't in the episode at all, I don't think we'd miss anything. Obvious. But if anything else, it did tie Wesley's story to the conspiracy story very loosely. I'm not sure I'd be so depressed at losing Wesley, and I wanted to run away from in a shuttlecraft, though. Let's see. I actually didn't mind the psych test aspect. Of all the testing they did, it would probably be the one that made the most sense. How would Starfleet personnel handle being thrown into their biggest fears? Well, it might happen, and it might put your own life and the lives of others at risk. If you can't deal with it, I'd say it's a necessary evil. Now, I'm going to interrupt myself again, Doc, and say, did we ever come up an analogy of the Kobayashi Maru?
No.
So why'd they abandon that as far as for... Unless that's just for Academy cadets who are already in the Academy.
Or yeah, that's like the captaincy thing. That's really meant for like potential command officers. You know, the whole thing about the Academy too, I mean, are we not forgetting that the Academy is for officers? And officers versus enlisted men? I mean, in the regular Army, there's far more enlisted men than officers, and you wouldn't send none of this, you know, none of those enlisted men come from West Point or the Naval Academy. So I don't quite understand why people are still up in arms about the restrictive nature of an elite organization amongst trillions of people, why they wouldn't be selective.
Mm. Well, as far as the Kobayashi Maru, don't forget, in the 2009 movie, Kirk actually takes the test, even though he's just a cadet. And, you know, what was I going to say about that? I mean, and obviously, you know, Kirk had a nice big set of mean guys.
True.
So, anyway.
Alternate timeline.
There you go. See how easy that is? Yes. All right. If this episode had seen more than just Murdoch getting into the Starfleet Academy from testing, then maybe I'd give this a 4 out of 5. But that stupid restriction is far too big an issue for me, and then I'm going to have to give it a 3 out of 5 instead. As for the question in the end... Thank you. I reckon young Jake and Nog would have hated Wesley. Season 1 DS9, Jake and Nog were far too fun compared with Wesley, smart and geeky. Each of would probably have gotten on a lot more with Wesley. Really? There's definitely two groups of two going on there. Maybe later in years, the four of them would have gone on fine, but in their earliest incarnations, I don't think so. Okay. So, you made it that far to the end of the episode. Good person. Okay, Doc?
Yeah, I'll take the next three, shall I, because the first two are irrelevant. That's short. So, first of all, hey, just obviously just a shout-out to Furbob for having come on for the show. Thanks again for that. I think he was a great guest. Paul from previous in the Alpha Quadrant has a short comment just saying it seems too hard to get in Starfleet Academy. How much do you get on the dole in the 24th century? Now, do you understand that reference?
How much do you get on the dole?
Yeah, do you know what the dole is?
Well,
the
welfare. It makes pineapple. It does.
The bananas.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. But it's welfare system over there in the UK, right?
James? Yeah, so it's slang for unemployment benefit.
Oh, okay.
So do you think that most people are on the Dolan Star Trek then, James?
Well, if they've got rid of money and they've replaced it with kind of like Federation credits or whatever, one way or another, I think a lot of people aren't working kind of like manual labor jobs or stuff.
Yeah.
So it's I don't know. It's a bit of a weird.
Hold on.
I don't think the door exists anymore at that point.
No, it wouldn't have to. Okay, let's think about what they do on the Enterprise. Okay, they work 8 hours a day, 10 hours a day, 12 hours a day. Doesn't matter. However many hours a day. What do? They go home. When we go home, we have food that we have to buy from our day's pay. So when they go home, they get to the replicator who gives them everything they possibly could possibly want. Or tonight, let's go out and see a movie. Hence, let's go to the holodeck. Or we could, you know, we can even take a shuttle and go on vacation. Pretty much, it's just like real life, only they don't get paid for it. They don't need to get paid for it. So no, I don't think the Dole would exist.
I mean, by the way, this is getting very close to, I think, a discussion they had somewhere else. I can't remember where it was, but I think where I got to in my mind is that as soon as you have an abundance of energy, I think the entire economic system collapses.
Of course it does.
So if you get to the point where you can feed and anyone can be, you know, everyone can be kept happy and safe, and there's nothing that anyone needs to do because energy is so freely available. And kind of by Star Trek, energy is freely available.
Energy coupled with advanced technology that layman friendly to use.
Yeah, sure. And I think it's only the scarcity of energy.
Well, it's the scarcity of resources, right, with economics. And once you eliminate the scarcity of resources, then the whole fundamental idea of economics and what we know of it goes out the window. Unpredictable culture that would lead to a lack of scarcity.
That's true. That's what makes TNG very much different than Voyager.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. All right, Doc.
Yes, I've never thought about it like that. Maybe it's, yeah, TNG exists in a utopian society, and then Voyager heads off somewhere. They've only got a certain amount of resources, and before you know it, they've turned themselves into, you know, 18th century capitalists, and they've got a slave trade going on or whatnot. It would have been fun. Okay, let me get over to Collins. Collins post. He says, "Wow, Doc on a rant." And actually, I did listen, and I did, didn't I? I didn't realize at the time that I had, but I did go off on one. You guys should have shut me up.
No. Earlier than that. I don't believe in doing that, and I don't edit people when they do go on a rant either. So I just, let's get it out.
Okay. Sadly, this suffers from Gene and his incarnation of a facet of his persona that is Wesley. It is well known that Wesley is Gene. He has stated it a number of times, and it's apparent in this episode. They wanted to show how seriously intelligent Wesley is, aka Gene, and to go to great lengths to show how the boy genius, who saves the ships every day, also has flaws. But it horribly backfires, as if you think about it, the test to take the test is so hard that your IQ would have to be ridiculously high just to take the test, just to take the pre-test. There we go. Now, you could argue that this is a test for command school, but even then it flays in the face of logic. Thankfully, by the time this crops up again in DS9, they decide to make it more reasonable, to make it more believable. That said, you don't have to go through the academy to be in Starfleet. You do, however, need to have gone to the academy to be an officer.
Question.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but they just said, crops up in DS9, they decided to make it more believable. Do you think maybe the idea that Nog can't read is that he can't read English, or he can't even read Ferengi?
Does that matter, though?
But it does, because I think at that point, by the time Nog would take the test, they probably would alter the test to read it in Ferengi.
Well, I would assume that there's a galactic standard language, which I think if you read lots of sci-fi, you can easily assume that, since they all have it.
Huh. Okay. I thought, I mean, just like, you know, Arizona, you probably know pretty much good having Sheriff Joe there that there's a lot of immigrants, and in a lot of applications are in English and in Spanish. So why wouldn't the Federation make an application or a test that would be both English and in Ferengi or in, I don't know, Benzong? Okay.
So, James, I'm going to just tell you, I'll be you today. All right. I'll answer all the questions.
Go ahead.
Mainly because I think that reason we have to have it in English and Spanish is because we do not have a true majority here of one language or the other, a primary speaking language. So we have to accommodate both people who are here because we want to maximize our efficiency and our we don't want a bureaucracy bogged down in translators and all that stuff. That's ridiculous. So we facilitate the ability to do paperwork. That makes sense. But I would say, though, that there is absolutely a supreme majority, since the Federation is, you know, hundreds or whatever, thousands of worlds, trillions upon trillions of people. And in order to unite them, they have to communicate. If they're going to communicate, they have to do it in a single language. I know the universal translator is the MacGuffin or the device that is used to give us that.
Yes.
But just see it that way. I mean, there is the idea of universal communication through some sort of standard form. We even talk about it today, and like the doc would know, mathematics is considered a universal language.
Yeah, true. All right, then the 24th century ACLU will have something to say about that.
You better believe there will be the ACLU of the 24th century.
All right, go ahead, Doc. Sorry.
Oh, no. I mean, just to quickly come on that. So two things. The fact that Nog is illiterate, I always took for him to be illiterate full stop, regardless of what language. So yes, I always thought that he was always, you know, it was shorthand for him being uneducated and dumb. Uneducated and his education or his outlook on life, not towards learning, but towards, you know, whatever the Ferengi get up to, bartending, I suppose, at that age. And then the other thing is that this isn't consistent throughout the entirety of Star Trek, and there are certain points where you kind of think, well, that has to contradict something else that has happened elsewhere. But I usually live happiest when I assume that everyone on Star Trek is speaking to each other in their native languages, and then people are hearing their, you know, the translated version through the universal translator. And I know that there are occasions where that can't be happening, and in particular when they kind of when Worf would be talking and then he'll throw a Klingon word in there, I've always assumed you're just talking Klingon and everyone hears you as English, and of course then the lips don't sync up and all of that jazz. But I've always assumed that it's that everyone speaks in whatever native language that they're educated in.
That's what I always thought too, because even in Little Green Men, you know, Quark says, your translator's malfunctioning.
That's definitely what they try to tell us, right? But they don't show us that all that effectively sometimes. However, let's go back to the Nog's ease of entry into Starfleet. Do we really, guys, consider that an easy entry? I mean, the boy, Nog, had to effectively admit that his whole identity was useless as a Ferengi, and that he was not going to be a good Ferengi, and therefore he wanted to create a new identity for himself. That takes an incredible amount of maturity, and that's something that would be respected. That difficulty of understanding yourself is worthy of entrance into Starfleet, I would think.
And actually, this kind of touches onto a point that I think I was trying to make in the episode, but probably not particularly well, is that I think it would have been much better for them to consider the test in terms of a maturity test. So what you say about Nog is very true, and I think he was at a stage in his life where, you know, he was ready for the academy and ready to take this next stage in his life. Whereas
he said, I'm hungry. You know what I mean, right? Didn't you say that?
No, yeah, indeed. Whereas I think Wesley is very naive at this age, and I don't think he has to fail because he's stupid. I think he can just fail because he's not mature enough. And there are plenty of people that are going to be 14, 15 and so on, and, you know, thinking about what they want to do in their life, but they are immature. That they're not mature enough compared to, you know, either a late teens or an early 20 kind of guy. And I think they should have made that as the discriminator between why he wouldn't be a good a suitable choice at this stage.
Wow.
Rather than rather than him being a couple of seconds behind on a on a question.
Okay. All right, I'm sorry, Doc. We better go on. I've never seen us go through this long in forums.
Okay, which itself raises questions. How can Wesley get a field commission? Aren't they given out in a time of war? How can Picard justify giving Wesley a promotion after he's failed the exam? Oh, Wesley, don't worry. You're clearly not smart enough to be an officer, so we'll make you one anyway. WTF. Oh, well, in that case, Mom, can you get up to the bridge and start flirting with a Picard? Apparently, if you do, that can make me an ensign. Sleep with him, and no doubt I'll be a lieutenant. Imagine the guys in the lower decks. Did you hear about Wesley getting to be an ensign just because his mum's relationship with the captain? Oh, yeah, really good for morale. Now, I don't think it's quite fair to put it like that, because Wesley's still going to have to go to the academy, so he's not bypassing everything. This inevitably leads to the most glaring question that the episode brings up. If he's not been to the academy and cannot pass the test, why is he flying the flagship? Why does he have unrestricted access to the entire ship, and why is he never in school with the other kids on board? That's it. That's why he failed. He's too busy saving the bloody day and fixing the ship to study. I would give this a 2. And Lou, now would be a good time to roll out the How to Kill Wesley episode of Lou Trek again.
Okay.
I like Colin.
You like what?
I like Colin. He's a funny dude.
Okay, well, that's show 61 of the Lou Trek show, and I can put a link in there. But let's go back to... I hate to keep dragging this out, but okay. You don't really see a problem with making him an ensign when everybody else is on the lower decks trying to muddle through their lives to even get into the academy. As far as a Jake Curlin thing, I think if they let Jake up on the bridge and they let him do the same thing, or maybe they let a couple other potential academy candidates come up and fly the ship, that would make it equal. But they don't. It's all Wesley or nothing. And that's wrong.
Now, I see what you're saying. But at this point, I mean, Wesley isn't really flying the ship, right?
Yeah.
Not in season one.
Oh, he's, no. Not yet.
He's No, what I mean when I say it's not as if Picard has bypassed the 4 years or however long it would have been of the academy. He is just, he's going to keep Wesley on board. No doubt he's going to get a bit of study and a bit of work to be done, bits and pieces thrown and help out some people. But I think in season one, we're not seeing Wesley. He's not the primary helmsman, which he later becomes, right? So I think the criticism is much more valid by the time you get to season three, or and he's in A, full uniform, and B, on the flagship as they engage the Borg at Wharf 359. That does seem a bit weird. But by this point, he's kind of like a guy hanging around, shadowing a senior guy. He doesn't have his own station and things like that. So I think it's a little bit different.
Now it is, but not later.
No, but I absolutely take your point.
Okay. All right, well, Medic 1849 says, similar to the Doctor, I have a hard time accepting Starfleet's entry process. How is it that they allow only one person entry per testing? How can a super genius kid and a Vulcan not get in? Yet people like Barclay, Nog, Troy, and every other quote-unquote red shirt gets accepted. I'm glad they changed the process by the time Nog applied. I know the writers wanted to provide a reason to have Wesley stick around longer. Why did they have to address this so early? He was only 15. Surely they had 3 years to worry about him applying. As for the psych test, I don't mind the idea, and I thought they picked an appropriate test. That being said, since Wesley didn't get accepted, is he to go through the whole test again? Is he to be challenged with the new psych test? I like the... Go ahead, Doc.
No, sorry. I think that's the best point made in this forum posted so far. And I didn't think of it. You go to the psych test, and then you fail, and then you come back the following year. You kind of know what your psych test's going to be.
Right.
So you've got a little bit more preparation than the others.
But in the next year, they'll change it up a little bit. Okay, I like the B plot in this story even more, so since they followed followed it up later on. As mentioned above, was Quinn and Remick already infected by the aliens? We don't think so. Or were they infected after this episode as aliens saw them as a threat to their plans? I was never too sure. As for your question on Jake, Nog, Wesley, and Ichib, I think early Jake and Nog would be having a great time, and we'd be pulling pranks on the other two. Yeah. However, Cadet Nog would be serious and would side with Wesley and Ichib, and Jake would be on the outside looking in and rolling his eyes at all three of them. Very good point. Overall, I rate this episode a 2. I still can't accept the whole Starfleet entry process. I think that's because there was no real entry process, and they just made this up as they went along. So, I mean, TOS, how do all those red shirts ever get in if they were that stupid? Some of them, how many times did they die at the hands of their own stupidity? Any comment?
I think, let's crack on.
And it says, yay, we had a listener reach the bitter end. We had two. And I don't see anything so bitter about it. That comes from another Star Trek quote. Okay. Wow. What time is it? It's time to go now. Thank you for listening.
Well, why did we ask Ben to tell us why he thinks this episode is awesome?
He does?
No, we should ask him why he thinks it is awesome. Ben, because we thought it was less awesome.
Do you think this episode is awesome, and why?
I'll tell you why it's awesome as we review it.
That's a good idea. So let's start with the captain's log. I've been thinking about doing this every week, James. Starting out with the captain's log. You know, he finds the head and he drops one. That wasn't funny. We're making our way at a very, very slow crawl to meet up with the shuttle carrying Counselor Troy, who attended a conference on why you don't leave the mothership and take a shuttle to a conference. We're traveling so slow because engineering is without a chief engineer this week, at least I think, and let the matter-antimatter fill up with a bunch of rubbish. See how I use the word rubbish there, James? You proud of me?
Sorry, what's wrong with the word rubbish? Why can't rubbish be used in a normal sentence?
I don't know.
Just take out the papers and the trash.
Yes.
Or you ain't getting no spending cash.
That's right.
By the way, I don't understand why they're going on adding post power. Like warp 6 is like 1,000 times faster than this. It's as if you're in your car and you pull over and you're fixing something on the engine, but while you're fixing the engine, you're asking your kids to push you.
Yes.
They don't need to be rolling along at this speed. There's absolutely nothing to gain. But actually, it happens a lot in Trek. It's not just this episode. Right. They seem to think that, you know, realistically, impulse is useless if the alternative is going at warp.
Right. That makes sense, yeah. All right. So, it will be good to have Counselor Troy back, won't it, number one? Sorry, Captain, I was just thinking about how good it would be to have Counselor Troy back. What were you saying? That's kind of what I got. It certainly will.
All right. Yeah, I mean, Picard and Riker here, you know, you think that they must be having some sort of conversations on the side. You know, that's obviously what's going on.
So, what'd you think about Yar's interaction with Worf about the martial arts competition?
Okay, so I like that they're setting up this relationship between... I mean, I like that they have the relationship between Worf and Tasha. I mean, they obviously would get along perfectly fine. The fact that they're talking martial arts makes tons of sense. We saw Yar in Code of Honor. You know, she's an Aikido mistress of some kind. So that's nice to know. And, you know, calling back to that character, part of her character is cool. But I really mostly like that they are giving us a change of guard. And they're doing that from Tasha's basically telling us as the audience that Worf is her equal, not in rank, but in character and stature and ability.
Yes, good point.
No, I think that's true. But also, I think that over the last couple of weeks, and maybe it's even longer, we have been noticing Worf doing a lot of things that you would assume the chief of security would be doing. So I think that there has been this push of Worf into what he will eventually become famous for, or his eventual role in as security chief. Right. But actually, I you know, this is a perfectly fine piece of character interaction, right? And it's there was a quote somewhere that stated that had Yar had this kind of character interaction, then she probably wouldn't have left the show.
Yes, that's what she says. And it was obvious to me from a few episodes ago, we're no longer looking at Worf's bum all the time. We get to see the front of him now, because he's been right next to her at the tactical station pretty much the last few shows.
I would like to take a moment, James, to address that thing with Worf and Tasha about Worf taking on more of the roles of security. I think we run into this problem on Voyager quite a bit, that it's very difficult to have a female authority figure in a active physical role. Captains do need to be active and physical. So we see this with Janeway a lot, where it's difficult for them to write episodes for her male subordinates in that same sort of idea of them being action-oriented as well. You know, because then her authority is automatically stripped from her because she is a female and he is a male, regardless of rank. And I think that's what the problems they ran into Tasha is. How do you give her character interaction as an authority figure and as a female?
Right.
Especially in 1988.
And we have had a couple of good Tasha episodes. I mean, I think, was it the very, very last one? No, it was 2 weeks ago when Blair was on, when we did Arsenal of Freedom. And, you know, she beams down to the planet and she kind of takes charge and she does a lot of the things that you would expect her to do. And she's, you know, I think she's pretty good. She comes across very competently and there's good interaction with her and Riker. And, you know, her and Riker have discussions and on kind of at the same level. Now, that was a good kind of use of Yar in that sense. If you roll back right at the beginning of this season when they had things like Hyde and Q, you basically had that role completely given over to Worf, and the role that she ended up having to do was that she got zapped away 3 minutes in or so to go and have a cry with Picard. And I think that that's the kind of stuff that really is the bad writing on the Yar character side. So I think that it's perhaps not necessary. It's not necessarily coming up more and more as the season goes on, but there have certainly been low points in the season where I think, you know, the Yar character kind of isn't being well written for. And I don't think there's anything, I mean, maybe I'm just not remembering properly, but I don't think that there's a problem per se with her being a woman. I think to a certain extent, I don't know, has she really been written as a woman rather than...
No, of course not. She's written as a man. But we see a woman. But we see a woman, and every time we see her do something like you mentioned, cry on the bridge during Hyde and Q, it's repulsive to us because she's not showing these tendencies of character traits. Strong, commanding, authoritative, and she's instead of being weak and vulnerable, kind of like they would write women to as a more familiar way to write a woman in that position. So we don't like those scenes with her. And that's why I think it works. The scene on the bridge of this episode works so well, is because she's able to interact with Worf, who's an alien that she can't have like a physical attraction to technically. And we can judge their interaction as a friendship and not as any potential romance. Therefore, they're on equal footing. So I think that's why this scene plays well.
If you guys were in a penalty box, Q's penalty box, knowing that if anybody else makes a penalty, they don't just join you in the box. They take over the box and you're dead. Now, isn't that a little... No. Would that make you just a wee bit sad thinking that? I mean, I don't know if everyone would simply cry and then tell the captain, oh, if you weren't a captain. No, I probably wouldn't have done that. But, I mean, penalty box, man, that's pretty scary.
No, sure, but, I mean... ish, in a way. The thing is that Hyde and Q, it's such a bad episode, and it comes straight off of Encounter at Farpoint, or relatively quick after that, and you see how Yar reacts in Encounter at Farpoint when she's basically faced with death, and she leaps up and then she confronts people. And I just think that the way that she behaves in Encounter at Farpoint, certainly during the scenes in the in the courtroom are completely at odds with how she then behaves in Hide and Q.
Right. Yeah, but and not then, at odds of how she plays this episode, which I think goes to show they may not have always had her character written correctly, but they knew who she should be. I just don't think that they quite had the concept of Crew in order to give her a pairing that she could, you know. Oh, the word I'm missing. Not flower. that she could thrive in. There were no character interactions for her to really thrive on outside of, you know, Worf and maybe Data.
Right.
The aliens.
Okay. All right.
So, well, Lou, let me ask you a question, yeah, since you're always asking questions. How do you like this opening teaser? Because we go from here, this interaction, and we straight away get cut into, you know, the emergency, the tension building, a Troy's shuttle crashing and going under power. I mean, how do you feel as you're watching, you know, this is like 4 minutes, 5 minutes. What do you feel like as you're watching this scene? Is it engaging, enticing, or are you just lounging while you watch this?
I'm pretty much just lounging. It really doesn't sound a red alert to me. It's because I guess looking back to today from 26 years ago, it's kind of cliche-ish. Why is she even on a shuttle? Why isn't the ship taking her where she needs to go? You know, no good deed ever goes unpunished in a shuttle. You can't go in a shuttle. Something always goes wrong. But I don't know. Just the way they did it was kind of like I was half expecting Ben, was his name Ben, actually?
Yes.
I was expecting him to say, well, thanks for trying, Enterprise. At one point. You know, like you know, last time.
I actually do. I'm going to have to slightly disagree with you here. Because rewatching TNG, I'm surprised how good their teasers are in general. I think I've noticed on more than one occasion that even if I think the episode is bad, I think the teaser and often, kind of like the first half of it is quite interesting. I think they have problems wrapping up the story. And actually, by this teaser, I actually thought the teaser was fine. I was actually quite, you know, interested, engaged. Yes, you know, you're basically in a position where, you know, the Fool has taken a shuttle, and anyone that wants to live shouldn't really be in a shuttle. And they've also taken the, you know, dilithium crystals out, and anyone that needs to use a starship shouldn't be doing that, because, you know, as soon as you take them out, you're going to be called away on an emergency. So there's a self-inflicted nature of the emergency, but I still think it's pretty good.
So the teaser in this situation, I mean, I think because of the year it is written really well. And I think that's why James likes it. And Lou, I think you rub up against it because it doesn't show us anything exciting. I mean, later iterations of this plot, this sort of plot devices, would have shown the shuttle in trouble.
Right.
And shown it being in danger. And so we would have seen it and not just been told about it. But I think I mean, outside your expectations, the first time around, I think it plays.
Yeah, yeah. I do definitely like later TNG teasers. They are some of the best. The Defector, for one. I mean, goodness. Yeah.
One of the best.
Yes. It's, the music, I think, makes it one of the best, too. So.
And speaking of music, this first season has its own unique scores and sounds. And you almost, beyond the uniforms, you know you're watching first season because of the music half the time. And this scene, as the shuttle is coming into danger, I really like the way that music plays in the background. It has this weird synthesized beat to it almost, mm-hmm. and it like almost strikes out at you as it's being played. Really gets your attention and tells you. And what they can't show us on screen, they let our ears hear. And I think that really complements it as well.
All right. Okay, but as you said, we have an emergency transmission from the shuttle. Oh, what a jolt. And next question is, where are you, shuttle? I don't know. I have a malfunction. Can you tell me where I am? Well, I read your coordinates as way off course. Confirm. What do you think about the confirm part? Confirm what? I just told you I don't know where I am. It's okay.
It's just the writing. You know, it's just what they're saying. The dialogue's not the best. Yeah. I would understand. I can understand that.
You wise guys, don't listen to me. Okay. So, what do you think about the drop-in chief engineer? I think he is Lieutenant Commander Leland Joe Franklin T. Lynch.
I mean, he refers to his full name, including middle initial, at least twice, I noticed.
Yes.
And there aren't people these days that really still do that, are there?
No, we ain't got time for this, Mr. Lynch. We need more power. I had to do that.
And I like the way that he, you know, when he sets up the, you know, when he sets up the engine and it goes through, it wants to go through the checklist. Oh. And he said, "Oh no, quit checklist." And then the computer says, "Well, that's not recommended." And he went, "Oh, I understand, but let's go now." I couldn't help but think, I'm assuming the checklist isn't going to be particularly long. I almost think that maybe it was going to take longer to argue with the computer than it would be to actually do the checklist.
Just press the button himself, yeah. Prime matter antimatter injector set ratio 25:1. Ah, wait a tick. Did this guy ever really take the entrance exam?
Are you guys seriously ragging on this guy? He's awesome. He does what he's supposed to. He does his job. I mean, Picard's like, "That's not good enough." And he's like, "Okay, fine. It's not good enough. I'll have it ready for you right now, sir."
But you're missing the point. The ratio.
What's the point?
Ratio of 25:1. I mean, just a couple episodes ago, we established that it was a trick question. It can't be anything but 1:1.
Okay, no, Lou, sorry, I'm the apologist. I'm going to come in. Okay, the reaction can't happen in anything other than a 1:1 ratio, but that doesn't mean you can't fill the fuel tank with different ratios. It just means that when you actually have the reaction, you're going to have one part antimatter for 25 parts matter. The matter is going to disappear. The matter is going to go down to, like, you know, 24 parts, and then you're going to lose the entirety of the antimatter. So you're not as efficient. That's all it is. That's my apology of the week.
Oh,
thank you, Doctor. Thank you for doing your job.
Okay. They're ganging up on me, guys. I don't know if I can do it. Anyway,
Yeah, the guy who said this episode is awesome and the guy who said this episode is not awesome are ganging up on the guy who said it's kind of awesome.
It's kind of awesome. It's okay. All right. Let's see here. Ben. No, I mean the other Ben, not you. Anyway, you're dangerously close to the planet Vegra 2. No inhabitants. We all know what happens, but do you think maybe the sensors should have detected something there?
Long range sensors, not as accurate.
I mean, regarding the pilot Ben, I'm just surprised that in a show where you have a black red shirt flying number 13 shuttle, it's Yar that ends up dead by the end of the show.
Yeah, well, because TNG don't kill off red shirts, thankfully.
No, that is true.
No. Yeah, Tasha was in the gold. So, okay. Anyway, Leland Joe Frank... Ah, never mind. Anyway, we have... we now have minimum warp speed, said speed to warp 8. I said minimum, Captain. Do you think...
You heard the order, sir.
Yeah. You heard the order, mister. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, well, I put in my notes, and, you know, maybe James corrected me, but what's he so worried about? You know, he just set the ratio, matter antimatter 25:1. The ship should be in tiny pieces by now, but I guess maybe not. Okay, so we beam down to the. Go ahead.
Okay, well, so this is Captain Picard here, risking the life of how many people on this ship? Like a couple grand, a couple thousand people on this ship. For two lives? Does that make sense? Hey, this is the captain that we revere as the greatest captain of all time. And don't question his decisions. Really? Okay.
By the way, I guess. I don't think he's risking it for two lives. I think he's risking it for one life. Because throughout the episode, they seem to be completely unconcerned about the pilot.
Yeah.
At the end, and we'll come to it, he beams into the shuttle, and there's a pilot who's hunched over and it might be in need of medical attention, and there's Troy sitting on the side looking a bit weird, and he goes over to Troy. I don't think at this point anyone cares about the pilot.
No. Nope. No. Well, he does check his pulse and look at his eye. So, maybe. But, I mean, was she busted up at all? I mean, couldn't she get up and use a tricorder and at least tell what was wrong with him?
No.
Okay. Because it's not a medical tricorder.
Right.
That's another one you'll hear, Ben, in the next couple of shows. Yeah, because I mean, you mentioned something, Doc, about a previous show, and I thought, well, no, Ben hasn't actually heard that yet.
Not Arsenal of Freedom. No, not yet.
No, not yet. Okay, so we beam down to the planet. We find the shuttlecraft is in pieces, but the main hull is pretty much intact. Now, Doc, and maybe Ben, can you speculate why the shuttle isn't destroyed?
What? That's not a... Is that a serious question?
Yes, it is, because...
Because it has Counselor Troy in it. That's why it didn't get destroyed.
Well, obviously that. But, I mean, you know, it's in pieces. There's another Voyager episode. Remember the one where Tuvok, Ensign Wildman, and I want to say B'Elanna? I'm not sure. Is on a shuttlecraft, and they end up getting so many kilometers under rock. How do they go under solid rock or into solid rock and not get destroyed?
Well, that episode was that the ground was unstable in that region. They techno-babbled that up.
Okay.
But also, the shuttle is going to be made of very, very hard stuff.
Okay.
That's, I mean, all you have to do to go through hard stuff is be made out of harder stuff.
And be going very fast.
Yeah, it's fine. It's absolutely fine. I mean, they crash landed the saucer section in Generations. It's fine.
It coasted. It coasted. Well, to a stop.
It coasted. Goodness.
It didn't hit. It didn't hit a rock formation dead on.
I think what it is the destruction integrity of the shuttles is very, very good.
And the people inside also, because they didn't bust up into little tiny pieces.
Inertial dampeners.
Oh, yeah. I mean, seriously, without inertial dampeners.
Everybody would die just by starting the ship up.
Everyone would be on the back wall in some type of soup.
Exactly. You've got Tom Paris on your avatar here, Ben. So what's his famous quote about, inertial dampers?
That's not Tom Paris.
Sure. Well, that's not. Of course. Yes, you're right. It's Captain Proton. But it's Tom playing Captain Proton. But what's his famous quote about inertial dampers?
I don't know. Tom and I aren't buddies.
Oh, okay. What he says is the ship could survive without inertial dampers, but we'd all be just stains on the back wall.
That's right, he did.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And
it's strange that did the inertial dampeners ever go offline?
Yes.
Because at that
inertial point, dampeners offline, sir.
They say that a lot, and every time they do. It's like, "Oh, come on." Obviously, backups must have kicked in.
They have their triple redundancies, let's not ever forget.
Right. Yes.
Also, the artificial gravity is usually a good system to keep on as well.
Mm. Yeah.
Very rare that goes off.
But, you know, if you float around, that's one thing. But if you slam the back wall at a billion miles an hour, that's not very good. So, what do you guys think of the oil slick today compared to 26 years ago?
So real quick, I would like to start this conversation off by asking, is anybody watching the Blu-rays?
I am.
Okay.
And by the way, when I listen back to myself, I always say, I'm watching the Blu-rays, I know, I can hear everyone saying, shut up, talking about the Blu-rays. I apologize, I happen to have a big screen TV, I have them on Blu-ray.
Yeah, me too, it's okay.
But I feel guilty.
No.
But I am watching on Blu-ray, and they didn't really—they haven't cleaned it up though.
You know,
was a lot worse than I remember it.
I'm gonna go to Netflix right now.
It's not good, period. And I think that's because whatever effect they used to create that, they just must not have been able to. I mean, I think they could have probably certainly gone in and CGI'd it, but then that wouldn't look familiar to the set and whatnot. I think that's why they probably didn't mess with it too much.
And, I mean, actually, one thing to say. I think I mentioned it right at the top of the show, but probably before Lou was recording. But I watched this episode today, and I watched it with my kids. So it's a 10-year-old, an 8-year-old, and a 6-year-old, and then a baby who doesn't really have any concept of Star Trek. But we ended up watching it, and you know, I kind of can see that the effects are a bit dodgy and stuff. But they liked it, and they saw the bit of animation where the snake kind of goes round and it moves, and it does look very ropey to me, but they didn't think so. And then I was thinking about what was I thinking about when I first saw it? And I probably would have seen it when I was 10 or something like that. And it, I do have a memory of this episode from the original run. And I actually think that it probably does the job in how spooky it is. But if you think it from a technical perspective, it's a pretty ropey, you know, it's a pretty ropey executed, but a well-designed, I suppose, alien.
Yeah, the concept's excellent.
Yeah, yeah.
What did you think of it, Lou?
Just fine. I'm sorry. Just, you know, I'll be honest with you. I'm actually looking at Netflix to see if I can get TNG on Blu-ray. there's no way I could afford that on Blu-ray.
You got to wait for the deals, Lou. You got to wait for the deals. Every now and then they come out with these specials of, like, you know, having overstocked, and that's when you pick those up.
Yeah.
When you have a chance. Or you give them to you for Christmas. That always works too.
Okay, so maybe I might have had a temporary stroke. So I guess what I'm asking here is, compared to 26 years ago, the way the oil slick looked, how's it look on the Blu-ray as it moves along and sits there?
Not that different.
Okay. Because, you know, when it moved in particular, it just looked like a piece of black moving on a screen.
It's kind of a crayon. Yeah. Someone's kind of drawn on the cell. Of the of the film, so I think that's what they did.
That is probably what they did. Okay. I don't know, but it's definitely not like a smoke on set. They weren't that whatever they were looking at was not on set.
No, and actually, I'd imagine. I mean, they've been pretty good, by the way, cleaning up a lot of the stuff on the film. So I would imagine that it is, you know, it might have been like an in-camera effect that they were able to put across or something in post. But I would imagine if they had the clean footage of the actual thing without the effect, they might have tried to clean that up. But it's certainly not, you know, it's certainly not good.
Okay. All right, definitely got to move on. Okay. I am Armus. Why are you here? Well, I'll give you 5 guesses. Oh, I'm sorry, you didn't guess right. You see that badly broken shuttle over there? Well, my girlfriend's in there. That's why we're here.
I love the fact, by the way, that I think even before Armus comes up, you know, that Riker kind of tries to walk around and it kind of stops him. And he hails up to the Enterprise and he said, oh, you know, Riker to Enterprise, I'm having trouble walking around this kind of puddle. And I thought that, you know, from Picard's perspective, who's just sitting there thinking, you know, have I really hired an incompetent here? it's pretty, okay, we later learn that it's a little bit more serious. But at this stage, Picard must be thinking that this guy is not really up to scratch.
So my solution would have been beam him back up to the ship and then beam a couple people on the other side of the oil slick and then see what he can do.
Or if two people walked in opposite directions.
Well, I got a feeling he could just expand himself. So why not?
They didn't try that.
No, but they did have the discussion of what is this. And I think that's the primary thing here. I mean, we could debate about it and we could try to play tricks and all this stuff and argue about technology, you can do this or that. But in the end, we have to, if something's alive and something wants us to listen to it, we have to communicate.
Right.
And I think that's exactly what they're showing us here, is that this thing is... Look at it like a mouse in an experiment. Will it react in a way that determines that it knows what it's doing? And that's exactly what they do here. The Armus shifts back and forth across the sand, tests their reactions. Do they keep walking back and forth? Are they that animalistic and instinctual? Just, oh, I'll go this way, no, I'll go this way, no, I'll go this way, and that happens forever? Or do they stop? And they think and have a rational thought process that says, what is going on here? This is not right. How am I going to deal with this? And that's what they do. And then they have a conversation with this entity. I don't see a problem. And I think I'll continue to just hit this over and over again. If direction is the only problem you have with this episode, then that's a really weak argument as to why this is not an awesome episode. Because that's the only thing I think is wrong with it.
Yeah.
And that's just 1988. And that is something we build a bridge over. And, you know, move on. Because the story here is shaping up nicely.
Yeah. I mean, it was sure daring for the time to kill off... Did I just say that?
Spoiler alert.
To kill off your one of your main characters. But, you know, I mean, I guess she was just unhappy. I've often said I would I would love to be on a bridge of the ship and die within 5 minutes of the episode. I'm okay with that. So, okay. All right. Well, then, Armus sure takes a lot of breath between words, doesn't he?
He is very breathy.
Yes, he is.
So does Darth Vader, though.
I wonder if he has oil breath or something. Oh, where's the other thing I thought you might get a kick out of? Hold on here. Okay, here we go. Number 19 says, I was watching this episode at 3 a.m. while pulling an overnight shift. And so I get paid to watch Star Trek, yes? No, it was a special thing, fire watch duty. Sprinkler risers were down. But anyway, I wonder if Armus has to change himself every 3,000 miles or, you know, like we change oils in our cars.
Oh, goodness gracious.
What was one of the things when you're all alone and your power goes out, you think of these things?
You know, I don't think I've ever thought how many times Armus needs to change over his contents.
Yes. Well, there's one to think about, Ben, and maybe you can put comments in the show notes with how he has to change himself and what happens if he doesn't. Does he get some kind of viscosity breakdown or something?
You know, I would answer all these questions for you, Lou, in a timely manner as well, except for I just don't think we have the time today. But do be aware, I could answer all these questions.
Go ahead. Okay, so what do you think it attacks Yar? What's the deal with the little oil spot on her face?
So, James, I think you can answer that question best. Why do you think, having watched it with your children, that oil spot is on her face?
Well, actually, I have a quote from one of my kids on that. Yar gets hit. She flies over. She gets beamed up to up to the Enterprise, although not directly to sickbay. You can notice. Yeah. And then she's got this. Yeah, she's got a bit of blob on her face. And the only thing that my kids get, and this was a 6-year-old. This is the more innocent there. He said, all he said was that doesn't look like real blood. That's fake blood.
Oh. Yeah, I guess it would be.
So has anybody seen The Fifth Element?
The what?
The Fifth Element, the movie, The Fifth Element.
Nope, not me.
No.
Oh, okay. Lost on you guys. Next!
Well, okay.
But The Fifth Element was after this, though.
No, it's just a commonality in showing. They're showing us that Tosh is hurt here.
Right.
And, I mean, your kid says it's not blood, it's fake blood. Well, that goes to show as well that this creature is not, you know, like us. He's not they like to use the terms corporeal, non-corporeal later on as we see, like, energy entities. This is not an energy entity, but he's also not even close to a humanoid. You know, nothing like us at all.
I wondered is if it was kind of like Armus basically slapping her in the face, which knocked her over and ended up killing her. And that's why the oil slick would still be there. I mean, it happened so fast.
I think it's just another point of direction used to show the audience, you know, who comes in. They missed the scene where Tasha gets flung across the set. They come in, she's on the sick bay, and what's wrong with her? Oh, okay, well, she's this dark spot on her head. That's not blood. What is that? You know? That must be something going on here, not normal. Oh. And they stay and investigate.
Yeah. Right. What do you think about Dr. Crusher and Deanna Troi's performances in this episode?
That's a good question.
Oh, good. Oh, I didn't know if I'd go through the whole episode with bad ones.
Well, I'll defer to you, James. What do you think of their performances?
I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that I'm the last person to be on an episode review podcast. But I've really been enjoying Deanna Troi in the first season. I think she's been pretty good. And I thought in this episode she was absolutely fine.
Oh, yeah.
And in general, I like Crusher as well. And, there are some Crusher haters out there. But I don't really see it. I thought that they did well. There's the... Well, all of the scenes in the shuttle with Troi, I think she does well to, communicate with the oil slick. I think that the way that she attacks the problem, so the way that she kind of phrases her arguments and speaks, and I think it's very natural from a from her character's perspective. I think that when you know, later on in the show, where Crusher ends up having to have a bit of a conversation with Armus about you know, about who she wants to kill and stuff, I think that, you know, that stuff's also fine. So I don't have a problem with any of them. I think that I actually have soft spots for them.
Yeah, I would agree with you, James. I don't see problems with acting from anybody at all.
Okay.
The whole episode.
Yeah. I kind of like their performances as well. I mean, it seemed like Troy was in the right moment at the right time, and I can't think of anybody else being in the shuttle would have any meaning, because they can't psychoanalyze Armus the way she can. So obviously they chose the right person, and you can't justify Counselor Troy running a shuttle, so she had to have somebody with her, and he was completely useless, so they just kept him unconscious.
So speaking of the shuttle, Deanna Troi, the oil slick dude, what about this first conversation between the two of them, where we learn about the bad guy, as we now know he certainly is, because he's killed somebody, of course.
Yeah.
Super bad. I mean, what do you guys think about his backstory, about this idea that he is the shedded skin of something that was purely good, and he is the purely evil portion of it?
I believe it went like, creatures whose beauty now dazzles all who see them, they would not exist without me. They perfected a means of bringing to the surface all that is evil and negative within, or within something. Erupting, spreading, connecting. In time, it formed a second skin. I think he says something like that. Dank and That's vile.
A direct quote, Lou.
Exactly.
Good job.
So actually, I like that, because he just killed Tasha Yar, okay, and they shot him with a couple phasers. And one of my questions is, what would have happened had they put the phasers on maximum? Would it have done any difference? So we now hate this oil slick until Picard goes down and talks to him, and then you see there is a backstory of anger, and there's a backstory of pain, and now you start to feel a little sympathy, just like Picard does. I actually wondered if it would be a good thing to take him with the ship, but then, how do you know he's not going to just start killing off people left and right? That's kind of what I think, James.
No, by the way, I think that I like the scenes in the shuttle. I actually think that the music or the score at least is pretty kind of creepy-ish when they're inside the shuttle. I think it's actually done quite nicely. I hear what you say regarding kind of like the backstory of you know, of Armus. I don't think we find that out in the first conversation. I think that comes in the second. But you know, as I mentioned, I think Troy is correct in how that she kind of handles it. And from one perspective, it could just be a, you know, a big bad blob guy that's angry and wants to kill people. But I do think that the backstory that they give is, you know, it is an interesting. An interesting nod towards something, you know, a little bit deeper. It's not just an angry alien or something like that. It's, you know, there is a little bit of a tragic element there. It went over my kid's head, by the way, but that's fine. I mean, things work on different levels, and you know, they don't need to know that. And if they ever be watching in 15 years' time, as they're doing their own episode review podcasts, then you know, they'll be able to have something to say about this. But I think that's you know, I think that this is, I think, fairly typical of how we're seeing some of these relatively big ideas or relatively good ideas come in for TNG, but sometimes don't quite get executed properly. And I think that really the only criticism that I'll have about the monster is really on the execution side. I'd like the oil stick nature. I don't quite like how he moves. I think that the voice isn't also. I don't quite think the voice is particularly menacing. But the backstory is good.
James, let me tell you something. You said you had a specific memory of this in your early runs.
Yeah.
My first memory of this episode is that dude's scary.
He was.
And it was the voice specifically. So I do remember that well. Probably what stuck out in me to the most about this episode was not Tasha Yar dying or any of that stuff. It was his voice.
And actually, by the way, I think that the image that I have, it's not the voice for me. It's kind of the man kind of portion of the monster when he comes out of the tar, mm-hmm. and it's kind of like some of it's dripping down. And I think that's always a horrendous thing because it's there's no you know, he doesn't have a face on him. It looks like it's a faceless kind of black monster. You can't quite see what it is. The other very strong memory I have on this, and it comes up in a little bit, is when Riker gets pulled in. And I think that as a kid, I thought that was absolutely horrendous because you're effectively being eaten alive by by this alien monster.
Well, I think Riker says it perfect, and it sums up everything I think about this creature, and he does it in one word. I mean, Picard asks him to keep an open communication, and we just start discovering this alien right before he kills Tasha. He goes, "What do you see, Commander?" And he goes, "Trouble." And that's perfect, because that's what this dude is, trouble.
Trouble. Okay. And as far as Dr. Crusher, going back to your question about Deanna and Crusher, I think Dr. Crusher did a wonderful job trying to save her.
So was that a joke, Lou?
No. No. I mean, she was just fighting. She didn't want to give up.
Since we're jumping all around, let's jump right onto that one real quick. To all the Crusher haters, when she says 90, yes. Bring it up to 90, that is emotional. You feel that when she says that.
Right. And, of course, her assistant Box, direct. Yes, yeah. Just do it.
Heart-wrenching.
It is. And, she's just fighting bitterly to try and save her. Let's try this, let's try that. Again. And you could hear her voice go down every again. And then when it was over, oh, it was sad. Okay. All right, let's see here. Where was I? What do you think about Data feeling his sense of loss about Tasha? I mean, he's obviously not human. So how do you think Data is reacting? Obviously, in the funeral scene, he tells us what he's feeling, but when he was standing there and she died, what do you think he was thinking?
Oh, that's a tough question, because I don't think Data has emotions, so I don't think he feels anything. So really, it's just, what does he think? And I can only imagine that he's observing the situation and analyzing the outcome and possibilities and all of that.
Actually, I think Data does have emotions.
Wait, what? Right now?
I think, yeah, absolutely. I think.
No, you're playing. That's projecting.
No. Is it projecting? He's certainly. Well, the thing is, the issue with Data, right? There's an actor portraying Data, and the actor has emotions, and in a certain way, the performance will have a certain emotional underlying to it one way or another. He's not going to be able to perfectly get rid of, the emotions. But the thing is, the standard description was always that, Data doesn't have emotions, but at least until he gets his emotion chip. But I'm just not convinced that that's true. But... And when you have like The Offspring in particular, and the final scene of The Offspring, I am absolutely certain that Data is feeling at that point. And I think that the fact that he doesn't call them emotions, or the fact that they haven't been acknowledged as emotions, I don't think takes away from the fact that they are emotions.
So, James, let me say something to you. You have a young boy, a young child. Yeah. So do I. And one of my favorite things to tell him, because he's a wild man, is, son, why don't we get angry? We don't get angry because when we get angry, we don't think. And when we don't think, we always make mistakes. And that's something you got to know, that when you're talking about these moments of Data, like in The Offspring, where he's hands are flying as fast as they can to save his daughter's life. You see the moment kind of at the end of here, the end of this show, where he sees Tasha. But most more importantly, when you see him in Measure of a Man, look at that hollow image of Tasha, there are moments where you see him not thinking. I would say at those specific moments, you could argue that there's some sort of innate response that is outside of program, as outside of, you know, his given program. It's just something from him being physically constructed. He has. So I could understand those moments, but to say that that Data carries an undertone of emotion throughout the entire episode or the scenes, I think A, diminishes those moments that I just talked about, and B, also is frankly just us projecting because we're people looking at a person playing a role on a TV screen, and we have to suspend disbelief, and we do so by saying, oh, well, maybe Data does have emotions. But the reality is he's not written to have them, so therefore he doesn't have them.
Well, right. He's not written to have them, therefore he doesn't have them.
Yep.
But when he's talking to Picard at the end, the inflection of his voice changes as what we would consider becoming sad at what we are saying about how, you know, my thoughts are not of her, but of myself. And, you know, it seemed like the tenor of his voice changed as the emotion seemed to well up inside. That's, and because it's a human actor playing an android, I don't think Brent Spiner can help but talk in that nature. It's human nature. But as far as Data, I mean, I don't know. Sometimes I agree with the doctor. It just seems like he has some kind of an emotion thing going on that isn't apparent or easy to see, but somewhere there's a little sneak circuit.
And by the way, I'm not suggesting that he's like an emotional man, that he's entirely driven by emotions. I think it's clear that he's not driven by emotions. And he's very different, by the way, than Spock. Because I know a lot of people say, well, Spock didn't have emotions. And whenever I see, in particular, Leonard Nimoy play Spock, it's so clear that he's playing it as, it's not a man that doesn't have emotions, it's a man that has suppressed emotions. And I think those two things are really completely the opposite. But with Data, I just believe, I mean, I think a related question, by the way, is that, you know, do you think that, you know, is Data conscious? And I would argue that he is. And I think that when you end up with that, I mean, you're fundamentally now talking about, you know, yes, he's perhaps not programmed in that manner, but to what extent is this, you know, either emotion or conscience or sentience? Is it an emergent property or is it a program property? And I just think that, you know, the glimpses that we have of Data throughout the show, he's not detached from events in the way that you would be if you didn't carry emotion with you.
I will agree with you here, James. Data is not an animal, and therefore he has something special about him that's inherent and seen but not easily understood, which would make him just like a human being. So I can understand what your point of view is.
Let me ask you both this question about Data's potential emotions. Let's go to Lal. Wasn't she programmed bit for bit from Data?
I don't recall the exact wording.
Because, you know, all my memories and programs have been transferred to Lal. So why did she have emotion and he didn't? And then we go back to Dr. Soon's lab, an explanation of why Data has no emotion when Lore does, because he was too emotional and they wanted to cancel that out. I got a feeling that's why Data probably does have potential access to emotions that are just somehow suppressed by programming. And when it was transferred to Lal, that suppression wasn't included in it.
I mean, also, I do think there has to be a distinction made between being programmed to behave as if you have emotions and actually having emotions. Because I think a lot of the stuff with the emotion chip, and obviously, but I'm thinking kind of going, you know, Descent, the end of season 6.
Right.
I think that the behavior there is much more of someone who's has been programmed in order to act according to a set of prescribed emotions. And I think that's a slightly different issue than having emotions.
Yeah. Plus, go ahead.
But we're going off on one here.
Oh, one more then. Plus, monkey see, monkey do. he's surrounded by people with these kind of emotions, and naturally, I got a feeling he's going to emulate some of them here and there. But, okay, anyway. Okay, so Marina's acting was good in this episode. You started to get a little sympathy. I at least got a little sympathy for Armas and what he was going through. Okay. Now, of course, I don't need to mention the fact that Geordi's heater fell out of his pocket. Excuse me. Okay, phaser. Falls out of his pocket into the oil slick.
No, you don't. I saw that.
Yeah, everybody saw that.
Yeah, he's trying to... Poor Commander Riker.
Yeah, Metamucil with printer's ink. I wouldn't have done it.
Sorry, does he actually lose a phaser?
Yeah, it falls out when he's running to the oil slick.
Yeah.
As Riker goes underneath, it must fall out of his pocket as he goes. Because right into the oil.
I've never noticed.
Really?
No, never noticed. Never noticed.
Well, then I think what they should have done is followed up with a thank you as he grabs it and pulls it in. You know, because then now he's going to figure it out and want a piece of the Federation's action.
Oh, wow, Lou. That was undertoned and devious.
Devious. That's why I had to say the heater.
The heater.
The heater. Okay. So, would you have gotten into the Metamucil with printer's ink?
For how much money?
That's true. How much do you think Jonathan has made from Star Trek?
That dude has made plenty of money to look back on his life and rationalize why he got in a pool of Metamucil and printer's ink.
Couldn't that cause some damage when it gets into your nose, your ears, and, I mean, ugh. Can you imagine him trying to clean that out of his eardrum? Or I guess put him plugs in.
Yeah.
Okay.
We do it all for the Benjamins, baby.
That's it. You make Benjamins?
I have made imitation Benjamins before, yes. They're not as good as the original, but I try.
Well, it's like I always say, I've got direct deposit, but my creditors have direct withdrawal. Okay, next. let's see. Okay, so now when Picard is talking to Troy and telling her his plans to trick Armas, don't you think Armas would have been listening?
That's a single plot contrivance of the episode, I think.
Oh, okay. Just give it to him, huh?
I'm going to have to, because that's not explainable.
Okay. But hang on. That's explainable.
Okay, give it to us then.
Well, he only speaks to Troy when he's enveloped around the shuttle, right? Whereas in this particular case, he gets, you know, quote unquote, beamed into the shuttle. Yeah. So Armas has stood out as an oil slick in the front of the shuttle. So in all the other cases when he's been communicating, he's actually been sitting on top of the shuttle. So
right,
I guess it does show a difference between the two states. Okay, I'll give you that.
Okay,
it's not clearly explained though. That's generally why I call it contrivance and not a hole, because a hole is something that can't be fixed. Period. And a contrivance is something you just have to think about long enough. So I like that. But I do think that scene is an interesting one only because, like, once I said earlier that direction is the biggest drawback of this episode. I think James pointed that out with his problems and troubles with Armas himself. My problems really come from the all these shuttle-based scenes. Yes, Marina Sirtis does a fine job portraying her emotions. Her voice is excellent. Her face is good. But she's laying down the whole time. And, you know, that's a bit of a problem story-wise that they put her in this situation. I understand plot-wise why it's happening. But the direction needs to make up for that a bit, and I don't think it does. And you know, we have a couple scenes with Picard here in this where it's mano a mano. It's Picard with the damsel, and then it's Picard versus the dragon. And here, Picard and the damsel isn't the greatest scene because it's shot inside this small little shuttle. I mean, I like the interplay between the two, but the dialogue feels a little... I can understand why people would find it chunky and forced and maybe not appealing as much, and they get to nitpick it, but I think that's solely a responsibility of the director.
Okay. All right, well, if anybody has anything else to add, we should go on to the final funeral scene.
Well, let's just talk about last scene with Picard, then him slaying the dragon, because that's super important, right? Yeah. I mean, obviously Picard's clever. Obviously, this is similar to Kirk logically failing the computer. You know, it's like Kirk and talking a computer to death. Picard's kind of doing the same thing. It's not a computer, it's an alien, but he's talking them to death, basically. And I just love how Picard points out every single one of his Aramis's weaknesses. I mean, this creature who's been showing strength and brashness and omnipotent power in so many ways, Picard goes and faces him down without fear. And I love that. That has always been such an... Think back to The Last Outpost. Riker faces down the portal without fear because they tell us in there in dialogue that the whole Sun Tzu story about why Riker does what he does. But here Picard doesn't have any... There's no reason for him in story and plot to face Aramis the way he does. He just steps up and does it because he's a man and he's the captain. Not a man in the gender sense, but a man in the sense of fearless, unwilling to succumb to fear. Which is also, by the way, what Tasha did when she died. Unwilling to succumb to fear, and she paid for it. And here Picard, you know, shows us the other angle. Tasha takes the angle of force. Picard takes the angle of cleverness, wit, duplicity, intelligence, and is able to save his crew and himself. And I think that's the only problem I have at the very end is because Data said it should be destroyed, it was. And I think that was a mistake, but everything else was excellent.
What? I'm sorry, what should be destroyed?
Aramis should be destroyed. Data said Aramis should be destroyed, so they shot the shuttle with that photon torpedo, but I always remember that, assuming that killed Aramis, too.
Oh, I don't think so.
Maybe not.
I mean, actually, Ben, if I can come in here...
Hold on, and because the reason why I say that is because now Vegra 2 is off-limits.
That's right, Vegra 2 is off-limits. Must have missed that when I was a boy.
Okay.
No, but no, I always assumed that that Aramis kind of survived in one form or another. The issue that when you speak about people standing up to him without fear, I also think that that's applicable to Crusher as well. There's the bit where, you know, he's controlling Data and he's, you know, Data's kind of pointing the phaser at people. And, you know, okay, she says that she's afraid of death, but she's been very kind of logical and very, you know, not being manipulated. And she kind of stands up to him during that. The only thing that I'd say that I'm not quite as generous as you in this particular scene, specifically because, and I had it written down in my notes, I do see too many parallels to, you know, Kirk talking a computer to death. And in this case, it's, you know, not a computer, and it's also not to death, but it seems like Picard's talking an oil slick into some type of existential angst. And to me, it just didn't quite feel right. I just didn't think that the... I mean, certainly when you have Kirk speaking to the computer, the type of logic that he uses is completely off. But I just didn't feel that this was as powerful as it needed to be in order for it to work, and as, you know, as powerful as apparently, you know, you've seen it as.
So you didn't see him utterly destroy Aramis in a minute and 15 seconds?
To me, I thought there was a logical disconnection between what Picard was saying and how Aramis is kind of, you know, collapsing into some type of horrendous depression. I just didn't think that, you know, Picard, you know, stated, well, you know, you consider yourself pure evil, that pure evil is that we would stop standing up to people like you. And then he feels hurt at that. And I just didn't quite see why. I felt that Aramis was too weak in this particular case. I don't think they successfully delivered like a blow to him. Obviously, from the script perspective, they did. But watching it externally, I kind of thought, not quite.
So you mean externally? So you're saying it was written just fine, acted just fine, but you don't like Aramis, so therefore you don't like this resolution?
No. I think it's acted fine. I don't think it's written fine. So I think that there are logical issues with the argument that Picard brings up. And if, you know, if this resolution was done with, I think, stronger arguments or stronger script, then I could see where you're coming from. But I think that the script is just... The speech is not powerful enough, and it reminded me too much like Kirk speaking a computer to death. And in my opinion, whenever Kirk spoke a computer to death, it was ludicrous, right? It's funny. It's not serious.
Really?
So if they had come up with a better way to defeat Aramis beyond pissing him off or making him feel sad...
Well, that would suggest that they would have to overpower him. Yet, this entire episode hinges on the fact that when in, on this planet, when in his domain, you have no power. No physical power at all.
Right.
Okay, it's only outside his physical domain that you have power, outside his sphere of influence. The question we have to ask ourselves, and the question Picard has to debate before going into this, when you're talking like game theory and stuff like that, is what is his sphere of influence? What is Aramis's range of control? If Aramis could control his Q, he could control the entire universe or galaxy or anywhere in the galaxy at a certain point in time. Then obviously we have to approach this contest differently or this showdown differently. But Picard rightly assumes through dialogue, techno babble, yes, but the dialogue between as Worf was discovering these energy fields and Picard. Got that information and planned that out. That was quite clever, of course. So he knew what he was up against. He understood his enemy, and he understood exactly how to attack his enemy in a way that he was at his weakest. And to say that you didn't see that, I can understand how you don't feel it. I can understand how, like, when you're watching, you don't emote that understanding of Aramis's perspective, or even Picard's perspective of superior ability. But to say it's not written right, I think they've consistently shown us time and time again who this Aramis character is. They've shown us exactly all the strengths, which inevitably leads to these weaknesses. These are classic strengths and weaknesses. And I think it's a classic way to deal with somebody who is understand who they are, understand what they can do to you. Don't let them do that, and you're free to go. And I think it's really good storytelling.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I think for the way they had to use the plot device to defeat him, I think it was pretty clever to, you know, just utterly piss him off and make his energy go down, and then we're done. So I think it was the best they could come up with, and considering the circumstances.
So. The circumstances of awesomeness, baby.
Awesomeness. So okay, the funeral scene. Let's go ahead and go through that quickly. What do you guys think of the funeral scene? Okay. Show of hands out there. Who cried the first time it went out?
Like tears?
Yes.
Hmm.
Oh, you must be one heartless guy if you didn't. Oh, come on. Everybody did. I still do today. The music was terrific. And she's, you know, the way she's talking. I've actually considered doing something like this because of her and Jack Crusher.
Oh, okay.
So,
did you like really identify with the part where she says, "I realized I could be feminine without losing anything"?
And there you go. That answers a question we had earlier too.
I know.
So you know, there are times when you can be feminine, like when you're in penalty boxes, and then there are times you got to be tough when you're tough. And she was tough when she needed to be tough, and she was, you know, soft when she needed to be soft. I personally wish they had kept her. I wish they had found a way to keep her.
Oh, she was been so much better than Worf.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, maybe not, I don't know. Worf stepped up, and because of Worf, we now have a better understanding of Klingon. There are things Worf had to bring to the table, but I wish they would have kept her. And if they needed to kill off anyone, let's go ahead and let Armus squeeze the life out of the shuttle pod and take Troy. Sorry, I really don't sometimes care for Troy. But then again, without Troy, we wouldn't have Luoxana. So, okay. I don't know what I'm saying. But funeral scene. I think...
So, James... sorry, Lou. Did me interrupt? Go ahead.
Sorry. No, go ahead.
I was going to ask James, what do you think about, as Tasha looks around this ring here and identifies the character traits, what she wants to say, her final goodbyes to each person? Would any one of the characters leap out to you specifically?
I think that... I mean, there's one kind of technical question that I have, which is more of a nitpick, which is that, you know, when she records this message, does she have to record for everyone that's likely to attend her funeral?
I wondered that.
And what they play is that they play for just the people there, or is it possible that they're going to sit through as she speaks about six or seven people that died last year, and she's just not updated her record since then? But, you know, that aside, I thought that the final scene was done very nicely with the actually the weakest part, and it's always grates me, and I don't know, you know, maybe the problem is with me. It's how she speaks to Riker, and it's when she refers to him as he's the best, and I just never felt that there was that kind of relationship there. I think so. I thought that was the weakest. For whatever reason, I just didn't feel that there was the connection between Riker and Yar that would have demanded that. I think that as she goes through, it's certainly shown at the beginning of this episode that she has a kindred spirit in Worf, and they've obviously been working together in the same part of the bridge. I think it's good, the conversation that she has with Wesley. And in particular, what I do like is both Data and how she sums up Data, because I think she's pretty bang on there. And then also her relationship with Picard, kind of that one of a father. And I think that that's, those two are the ones that kind of stand out for me.
You left out Wesley, but that's okay. You can. I don't mind.
I did mention Wesley. I thought I mentioned Wesley.
I think you accurately identified that entire scene, Doc. I'll give you, you asked a question. I'll answer it. You asked why Riker and her don't play together. Well, I think that has a lot to do with the fact that, one, Riker's obviously emotionally and romantically involved with Troy, so that's off the table. That part of Tasha and Riker's relationship can't exist. They're the same age, so she can't admire him for his expertise or experience. All she could do is his current actions, but that doesn't make sense because she's a warrior too. She'd be in competition, not in admiration, which is why she plays so well with Worf. And I think that in the end, though, this boils down to the fact that she's a guy, he's a girl, he's in technical command of her, and that makes having a relationship between the two of them very difficult to do. I think if you were to reverse this and have Riker as Tasha, have female Tasha as the male, Riker as the female, then you have Picard as the male, the ultimate authority. I think then that's this scene would play better with character interactions. That's certainly not to say to all your listeners that I have any sort of gender predisposition, because it's actually quite the opposite. I just like to identify these points of which between the genders we stand apart, and it can be difficult for us to understand each other. And I think this does a good job of showing one of those issues. Okay. But that's why that doesn't play well. But I think beyond that, the entire funeral is most important to me, because there's Tasha standing on the pad, and in Measure of a Man, Data packs up his bags and takes his hollow image of Tasha. And it's this hollow image here from this episode here, which when I watched that episode, I remembered this episode and I remembered that scene, and all of a sudden the emotional impact hits. But it took a whole season to get that payoff.
Okay. All right then. In the end, we do like the funeral scene. It's sad, and I still get a lump today when I hear Hailing Frequencies Closer, because that's the last thing she'll ever say to anybody. So,
I think that's a good sign-off line.
Yes, it was great.
And then Picard calls her Natasha.
Yes, au revoir, Natasha.
Beautiful.
So, all right. Okay, unless anybody has anything else, it's now time for our final thoughts and ratings for this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. We already know what Ben says. He says everything's a 5.
Oh, really?
But we'll give him a chance to explain anyway. So go ahead, Ben. Tell us what you finally think of this and your rating on a scale of 1 to 5.
Well, I think I've said what I thought about the episode pretty much throughout the entire episode. I guess I have a question first before I continue, though. Mm-hmm. Lude, I have 2 ratings for you.
Okay.
Do you want my personal rating, or do you want my objective rating?
I don't even know how you can separate the two.
Oh, quite easily.
You're a lot more analytical than I am, then.
Okay.
I think it has to be personal, because we've done a lot of season one already. We're watching it. I think objectively, I don't think you can necessarily justify given the high marks that I've given it.
Oh, sure, I can.
And I go through it. I think I love this episode 5, and people look at me and think, season 1, 5 stars? You're crazy. and in general, I think we're running higher than, objectively speaking, we should be.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think you guys don't need to be hard on yourself and don't need to listen to the nitpicking force that is those haters. Yep. Be yourself. Do your thing.
Oh, we don't.
Okay.
The good thing is, the good thing is about our feedback that we've received, I have not once seen anything negative that we're crazy, that you're
worried. Oh, no, you guys are great.
Yeah, so we're having fun, and that's what shows. But
tell me, personal, Lou, or because you're the one who brought up the 5 stars and asking for ratings. So if you're asking for my rating, I'll ask you, which one do you want, personal or objective?
I'd say it's up to you, or a mixture of
both. No. It's your choice.
I don't know. Okay, I'll go with the doc and say personal.
Okay, personal is simple. Oh. It's a 5. Anytime you resonate with something and it has an impact upon you, you can't but say it's excellent. And excellent is top-notch. And top-notch on a rating system is the max points. So that's what I give it. Because this episode is incredibly impactful. And I think when you move yourself from trying to make this universe real, and you just look at it for a set of stories, this story told here is amazing. And it's awesome. And it's deep. And it's lasting. And it'll go down. If not from this iteration of this story will last forever. Okay, maybe not with the names Tasha Yar or Captain Picard, but this story of good versus evil, of intelligence versus force, will be told forever. Of personal loss and endangerment and self-sacrifice for others will be told forever. And this episode has that all. And if you were to be objective, you would see that, I think, quite quickly. I think it is because we're subjective that we watch these too much and we get too up in arms about what we want versus what we're given. And when we accept what we're given and look at it from that standpoint, I think you can't but say this is an incredible episode. Okay, so I fibbed. Just like Armis, I lied to you. I'll give you my objective rating because it is my TDQ rating. And that is really what you want anyhow, Lou, is my TDQ rating. My TDQ rating of this episode, unfortunately, very unfortunately, I couldn't get to that point of giving it full marks at a 5, but I give it a 4. And that's solely because it's my fault we're on a truncated time schedule.
Truncated time schedule?
Yeah, because we had a review. I only had 2 days to watch get ready for this episode.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, same here. Yeah, okay. Well, then I'll go next. While I personally don't get how the oil slick could possibly do what it does, or why it's even there, I like this episode mainly for the montage at the end and the buildup of Tasha's death. Sometimes I think Counselor Troy is almost useless in the first season, but in this episode, she's in the right place at the right time. And again, like I said, imagine if there was anyone else in the shuttle at the time. It wouldn't have had the same effect because they wouldn't have been able to psychoanalyze Armisen in order to defeat him. Tasha's death was not becoming a Starfleet officer. There was some back and forth on Memory Alpha about whether she should have died a more glorious death, and that's one of the reasons they brought her back for yesterday's Enterprise. So I wish they had done a little bit more than just a plain old oil slick slapped her in the face and knocked her down. I don't know. I would have liked to have seen her die defending the captain. Maybe he'd attack the captain or attack the first officer. She went for him, and then she got killed in the process. That would have been a little bit better. But tossed around by an oil slick? Eh. Denise's character will get much more fitting death later in Season 3, and that will be a 5-star episode. I'll give you a hint. What else? And then even come back for a few more times after that, playing some pretty good roles. Now it's time to see Worf become an entirely new character, and it's time to grow the Klingon people, so let the honor begin. The funeral scene, very sad, brings out the emotions every time. I don't know how you can watch that and not get sad. Even Captain Picard did his best not to cry and failed. So, I think even though most of the episode was pretty mediocre or pretty good, I'm going to still bump it up because of the end and give this one a 4.
Okay, then I suppose I go next here. Oh, dude, I'm going to be sticking out by myself. and it's not because I'm going to give it a 5. But I mean, I completely take on board everything you say, Ben, about this being a, you know, at its heart, a kind of like a big story, a good and evil story that's there. And that is true. But we've seen a lot of cases in TNG season one where you have these kind of like these big stories and they just don't particularly get executed very well. And like, I know that, you know, this is a story of, you know, good versus evil, but for whatever reason, it doesn't draw me in that way. It's almost as if you want to see the story, if you want to find out this, you know, this big battle, you have to like dig deep into the episode rather than the episode kind of drags you in. I think that the episode's kind of rather plodding. I do have to disagree with Lou, though. I actually like the way that Yar is killed. I don't have a problem at all with how she is kind of got rid of, and I don't necessarily think that every single character in every single TV show has to be killed by, you know, whilst taking a bullet for the president and saving a couple of babies from being run over by a car. So I think that that's, you know, I'm absolutely fine with it, and it is relatively believable from my perspective, and certainly when you think about the backstory of Armus, then, you know, a lot of what was done, I can kind of certainly understand why he would have behaved like that. Whereas I didn't necessarily think building up to a big glorious death or whatever would have necessarily fit this particular story. Actually,
you know, having James, said all, James, go ahead. Real quick, I just want to let you know, I knew I liked you for a reason. Everything you said about Tasha and the alien, you're spot on, man. That death was great.
No. And by the way, I didn't actually necessarily think that this story has to involve the death of Tasha.
Okay.
I think that it's a little bit tacked on. It doesn't, you know, in order for the story to work, you don't have to have killed a main cast member. So I think it's more that this story was around and Tasha was wanting to leave, and they kind of like merged the two. Actually, I quite like the fact, by the way, that they got this out of the way, you know, before the season finale. I don't think you necessarily need the season finale to be the kind of like the changing of the guard. And I think that one thing that I didn't like about when Jadzia left DS9 is that, you know, you almost work Terry Farrell up to the hour than she's due to leave, and, you know, you kill her off in the final scene. And I didn't, you know, I think that having this a little bit earlier is a bit more of a kind of like a, you know, a shocking, you know, it's not a kind of like end of season finale kind of a cliffhanger situation. So I actually, you know, I at least enjoy that. I do have strong memories of this episode that I gained while watching it first time round, you know, all those years ago when I was 10, so it couldn't have been that bad. However, I just don't quite, you know, I don't quite have the emotional connection to the storyline going on here. I think that Troy is good. I think that Yar's scene at the end is good. I think that there's a fair amount of good stuff. I don't think we get the payoff that perhaps the kind of like the underlying nugget of the concept deserves. And in my mind, this comes in as a kind of like an average episode. So I'm going to be giving it a 3. But by the way, there have been a large number of episodes where I've come in with a number and I've changed,
yes,
as we've discussed.
Yes.
And I think we have a tendency to migrate towards each other. So, you know, either I move up or you move down, or we do a bit of both.
Okay. All right. And we've done 23 episodes. And just a quick aside note. So far, out of 23 episodes, I have rated season one a 2.61, you've rated it a 2.74, and our guests have, seven guests have rated it a 3.64. That's quite a gap.
Selection bias.
Yes, but it does calculate that there's only seven guests and they had a combined score of 25.5 points. So yeah, it's interesting. We'll see how the next three episodes, we only have one guest so far. All right, guys. Well, I've got to roll, so we're going to have to wrap it up. Doc, if you want to go on to We'll Always Have Paris for next week. But first, Ben, why don't you remind everyone where we can find you?
You can find me over at the Delta Quadrant. We release episodes on Thursdays. And right now we're in the middle of the third, whatever. We're somewhere in season six, but the episodes are all good. So join us if you want to.
Okay. And I do want to put a shout out to a guy named Data Logan. Doc, I think you may have received some of the emails from him. He sent messages dating back to May about he wanted to be on a couple episodes in season two, and he sent them to the battlebridgepodcast@gmail.com. And in my badness, I was not checking that email whatsoever. And so I apologize to him, and I have put him in the episodes that he has requested, because technically he requested them first. So we have made a couple adjustments to the schedule, and you can check them all online, and there's still plenty more to go. But I'm loving the fact that we got lots more action in season two where people want to come on, and I imagine season three will be even better. So thank you, guys.
On the next episode of Star Trek, The Next Generation...
Two to beam directly up to sickbay.
A mission to save a dying scientist uncovers a deadly time experiment.
Captain, it must be stopped.
And reunites the captain with his first love.
We need your help. The situation is not good.
Now, they must save the galaxy from this crippling time distortion.
Only one of us is in the correct time continuum.
On Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Okay, so join us again next week, where we will be reviewing the episode We'll Always Have Paris. So that's episode 24 of season 1. So until then, I'm James from London.
I'm Ben from Arizona, saying adios.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska, saying good night, everyone.